is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We all hear Locus Cerulius. That cat is going
that cat's just not shutting up tonight.
By warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. And this warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit. Keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working for you, Jeremy?
Oh, yeah.
Can you feel it? Yes. And I'm Randy England, and this is the Freedom Fiends. It's just Jeremy and I tonight, unless Michael would poke his head in here, but we're ready to go. How have you been, Jeremy?
Oh, you know, hanging in there, same old, still stuck in New York, but hopefully getting ever closer to getting the heck out of here, so...
Well, that's kind of exciting. I haven't been on the show for a couple of weeks, so
we talked recently. I was going to say we talked recently.
Well, yeah, I was on your show, The Seeds of Liberty. Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Yes. That's the one that has the weird graphic with the guy with the pot on his head.
Johnny Appleseed.
Oh, okay.
Our version of Johnny Appleseed. It was modeled after my co-host, I believe, Dave, originally, because he has a gigantic beard like that. So,
that's kind of a North Atlantic legend, isn't it?
I think so, but he's from the South, so who knows.
That's right, Alabama, I think.
If
I recall.
That's correct.
Well, I was kicking around trying to find some things that would be interesting to discuss, and I found this is probably a month old, but it still was interesting to me, about the minimum wage and what's happening between the many states, apparently, that are looking at getting these, $15 an hour minimum wages, and
it's coming here to New York apparently, at least in the NYC. I guess it's coming soon.
Is that right?
From what I've been hearing, yeah, I don't think it's the whole state. I think it's just New York City that's going to implement it. But that seems to have been I don't think any state has implemented it yet, right? It's just been cities like the city of Seattle did it in Washington.
I think that's right.
You know, I think I know there was a couple other, but they're escaping me at the moment. But I'm almost positive I heard the rumblings that New York City is set to increase it maybe next, you know, coming as soon as this coming year, which was only a couple of months away at this point. But
do you have a hamburger chain called Shake Shack up there?
Yeah, mostly in the city and in Queens, because the most famous one, or at least the original most famous one when they first came here, was at the new Mets play, Citi Field, when they opened their new stadium. They have a Shake Shack out in center field, which is actually the one and only time I've ever had Shake Shack, is because the one time I went to a Mets game, which was hard for me because I grew up a Yankee fan. But free tickets are free tickets.
The story is that Shake Shack is it says it's a burger chain, and has a new restaurant in New York that's taking away the traditional cashier's counter, and instead the guests will use a digital kiosk or their mobile phones to place and pay for their orders. And of course, the cashiers that normally did that work are gone. I guess they're gone. It says the order will be processed immediately to the kitchen, and the guest receives a text message to come up and get their food when it's ready.
Now that point is awesome, because the kiosks thing has been floated around ever, even just in like meme form as a joke. When people started talking about this, it was like, well, here you go, folks. This is what's going to happen with your $15 minimum wage. You're going to be paying these robots, because that's what's, you know, and everybody kept saying that, you know. So that was one thing, but to be able to use your phone to place the order and get a text message when it's ready, like, that's awesome. I'm sorry, great, because then you don't even actually have to go into the restaurant until your food is ready, because you could place the order from your phone from outside down the block wherever, and you know, get, you know, take your sweet time getting down there.
But this is kind of a, you know, an early pink slip for Shake Shack employees. It says it's likely that in the next 15 to 20 months that areas like New York, California, and D.C., in which there are many Shake Shacks, will transition to a $15 minimum wage. Adopting this payment policy in this particular restaurant will give the company a chance to work the kinks out before it rolls out their $15 minimum wage in those locations. And I guess they mean rolls out the kiosk too in all those locations. And I guess everyone that was going to have those jobs will be gone. You know, I wonder if they thought about, you know, when you go into, say, a McDonald's, you tend to have, you know, they'll put the ladies out front. If you got a cute girl on the register up there, that's so much the better, right? And then the more the guys are in the back kitchen. I'm thinking that this is going to come down harder on the female employees at like a fast food restaurant. What do you think?
I hadn't even considered that, but that's actually, I think that's a pretty good point. It definitely could slant that way and affect them in an even greater capacity. And because I was just reading over the article again, and it does mention that, you know, they fully intend to be pay the remaining employees $15 an hour, you know, assumingly to comply with the mandate at that point, because they targeted the three cities they're talking about are all cities with the $15 minimum wage on the ballot somewhere, or, you know, getting ready to be, because DC, I think, is actually the next one that's actually supposed to get implemented there next, and then I think New York's after that. To comply with that, they fully intend to pay the remaining employees, but how many are going to be remaining? And yeah, like you said, it could definitely, you know, depending on the makeup of the staff to begin with, it could definitely disproportionately affect females more.
And they were talking about a study, a paper, and if I'm reading this right, saying that minimum wage, there have been a lot of studies, I think, but each dollar of increase of minimum wage increases the unemployment rate, or decreases the employment rate. That'd be the same thing, wouldn't it? By maybe a percent. So I don't know if that means if your employment was at 5% and you had a dollar raise in the minimum wage, it would go to 6. But I think that it's not across the board. It's for workers in that category. So for and I think they call them low-skilled, automatable jobs. So apparently there are some jobs that can be taken by, you know, a kiosk or something like that, and some that can't. And they're all, of course, they're low-skilled jobs, and they are...
Entry-level positions or
entry-level.
Or just factory stuff. I think this usually when this topic comes up and they're talking about these type of numbers, especially because it specifically mentions manufacturing, I think a lot of it is tied to, say, like the auto industry, because that was, you know, because this covers from 1980 to 2015, that particular study. So it would actually, you know, that would fall right in there with the automation of those jobs, you know, just the assembly lines becoming more and more efficient and having less and less need for actual physical workers, because the robots are taking over there too.
Yeah, you know, of course, entry level and low skill sorts of jobs are the only kind of jobs that are implicated by minimum wage. I mean, they're the only people that would get an increase in their pay, and they're the only people that would get fired if they didn't quite come up to that level of productivity. I mean, what do you do if you're the guy who's, you know, producing $14 an hour for your employer and the minimum wage goes to $15?
I don't know
how they could keep you or why they would keep you.
Well, unfortunately, again, depending on the state, but because of the insane labor laws in some places, in some cases, they may be forced to keep people for a while because, you know, firing people, they'll file suits against you and, you know, they'll come up with anything to try to make the big bad, you know, the big bad boss man look like the bad guy, even if he is just making an economic calculation like that. But he, I mean, $14 to $15, that's I mean, that'd be one thing. When the prices, you know, go this high, when they're looking to raise it to $15, like in most places, I mean, I think in New York, I think even in NYC, I think the minimum wage currently is still only $8 or something, $8.50 maybe. So, like, this is a huge increase. So people who may have barely been worth the $8.50 at the job they're doing are now going to be, you know, they have to come up, they have to be twice, more than twice as productive to actually be worth that money. Like, how many people are actually going to fit that bill? You know, it's so crazy.
It really is. Have you heard of the place, the pizza place called in the, I think it's in the Boston area, called Dudley Dough?
I hadn't until you sent me this article.
Dudley Dough is I think it's still in existence, a pizza parlor in the Boston area, you know, one of the suburbs or something like that. It says, Dudley Dough, a fair wage pizza parlor dedicated to economic justice in Boston, is going to close its doors. And maybe it's closed them now. I checked their website earlier today, and they still seem to be open, but they were getting ready to close because it can't make enough profit, which is probably the reason that lots of people, you know, businesses go out of business, and that's always sad. The challenge for Dudley Dough was to support itself, said Bing Broderick, executive director for the nonprofit Haley House, which oversees the shop. After just 2 years of operation, the Fair Wage Pizza Shop will close in the next few months. And this was a month ago when they said this. And the shop is very popular, but it's not even breaking even. It's losing money. And they market themselves. They are pizza with a purpose. And the deal is that all of their employees are given a, not only do they earn a fair wage, yeah. Well, they earn a, I think they call it a living wage.
Living wage, fair wage.
We'll be back pretty soon, right?
Yeah, talk more about this.
All right, we'll come back to Debbie.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell 411 has decentralized ride sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell 411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell 411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
So we're back. And before the break, we were talking about things like the minimum wage and the rise in the minimum wage and, you know, people getting replaced by machines, the kiosks are coming. And specifically, we got to this one particular story that Randy brought about Dudley Dough, this pizza shop up in Boston that sadly is having to close its doors after, I guess, 2 years or less after they were attempting to pay all their employees, quote unquote, a fair wage. And I think that's as far as we got before we hit the break. And of course, the term fair wage is not actually defined ever. Just like its close cousin, I guess, or maybe this is just a new version of it. But the living a living wage is what usually gets touted out, you know, gets brought out there. But that's never really defined either. It's just this vague term that, you know, can just be bounced around and draw on people's heartstrings. And, you know, of course, you have to be paid enough to live. So a living wage, you know, but it's meaningless. But, you know, they set out with, I'm sure, you know, great and noble intentions that it was, you know, they want to pay people, you know, higher wages than the minimum wage without being forced to by the government mandate, which is, you know, as a former business owner, you know, I have no problem with that. I mean, I paid above the minimum wage. I mean, I actually basically paid people essentially when I did have people working for me back in the day, I basically paid people $20 an hour to walk dogs for me. So, like, you know, and I wasn't pressured to do it. It was just something I did because I was able to do it under my economic model. These folks set out their economic model and they wanted to do it and they wanted to, you know, stick to this principle of theirs. And it didn't work out. But one of the things, a couple of things that really struck me from the article itself was right after it goes on to talk about fair wage, there's a quote from a Mr. Luther Picnicky, who was a team leader at Dudley Dough. And from my experience in food management and retail, usually a team leader is some kind of manager, like a low level manager. Not an official manager, but on his way there. But his quote was, quote, "I don't think anyone is looking at this as a failure," unquote. And I just laughed so hard when I read that. And then it was great because in the article, the very next line they write is, "But Picnicky's statements contradicts those who relied on their jobs," which, yeah, everybody who was there who had a job and was like, yeah, I got this great job. I'm working at a pizza place. I'm getting paid, you know, whatever amount, you know, obviously much more than somebody at a pizza place would normally get. This is great. And yeah, now my job's just gone. It's not, I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't fired. My job just doesn't exist anymore. And yeah, so for them, I'm pretty sure those people look at it as a failure. And just in general, the fact that it's, you know, they have to close their doors. That's kind of the definition of a failure in the business world.
It really is. One place in the article, they also noted that three other restaurants opened up in the same area about the same time as Dudley Dough, but they're still operating. And the article goes on, "The irony is in Dudley Dough's mission statement of economic justice for its employees who will no longer be employed. Not only will they no longer earn a fair wage when the restaurant closes, they will no longer earn any wage at all." You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, you have the minimum wage and you have people who could never work at all. They just can't work because if the minimum wage is, you know, $7.50 or $8 or $12 an hour, it doesn't matter what it is. But if you produce less than the minimum wage, you cannot work. It's as simple as, even when you were paying dog walkers $20 to walk your dog, I mean, I assume you're not saying that, yeah, people were paying me $15 to walk their dog and I hired somebody and paid them $20 to walk the same dog for the same $15.
No,
only I gave them $20.
I was a much better business person than the people at Dudley Dough, apparently. So, because no, that was not the deal.
No, and but it would not have mattered. No matter how kind-hearted you were, you wouldn't have stayed in business for so long.
Yeah, but, I wouldn't have gotten 12 months, much less 12 years. So yeah.
And you read, yeah, Luther Pink. Now, and the reason, I don't know if anyone's thinking, when you were reading about Mr. Pinckney, you pronounce his name differently each time you said it. And it's not your fault, Jeremy, because
I was just looking at that.
Spells okay, it so differently it each time it's written.
I thought that was the case. And then when you started to say that, I'm like, look what it really is. Quality journalism, folks.
You thought you were tongue-tied there. Yeah.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
I love the Freedom Fiends. But in this modern busy world, I just don't have time to listen all the way through every episode.
There is a solution. Go to the World Wide Web and log on to digest.freedomfiends.com and subscribe to the Freedom Fiends Digest. Digest.freedomfiends.com has 20-minute best-ofs of each episode.
20-minute best-ofs? Digest.freedomfiends.com sounds great. How much does it cost?
That's the best part. It's free. And if you listen at 1.5 speed, they're only 13 minutes long. Plus, the episodes are only about 15 megs, which is great, because I have a limited data plan.
Wow. I'm at digest.freedomfiends.com right now. It's so simple to use. And anyone who doesn't have 13 minutes to listen to the Freedom Fiends is a big old statist.
I agree with you about people who can't find 13 minutes to listen to the Freedom Fiends Digest. That's digest.freedomfiends.com.
My weak little meow just gets drowned out by the Wampus Cat.
I'm so sorry.
I don't know why I bother.
But we're back, and I know that you wanted to mention that poor Dudley Doe, even though they're going out of business, they had a big leg up over all the competition from the beginning, right?
Yeah, competition, because you mentioned the fact that three other restaurants opened at the same exact time.
Those three restaurants Dudley Doe got?
So on top of screwing up and not being able to pay their employees that fair wage anymore, despite claiming to be very popular in the area, no figures are provided on what kind of money they were actually making, but despite being popular. Not only that, but on top of all that, they got a $100,000 donation from the owner of the New England Patriots, Robert Kraft, and they still managed to blow all of that in under 2 years. So, I don't know how, obviously, unfortunately, probably a lot more, but I was going to say, I don't know how much more evidence a lot of people would need that these type of models just don't work. Because I think I was mentioning to you earlier, I think it was during the break, though, that there's been other companies like this that, there was one, I keep forgetting, but I know there was one in either Seattle or Portland, some kind of deli or something that had a similar type of setup where they wanted to pay people all this extra money, and they ended up having to close in very short order because they couldn't, the business model just was not sustainable. And then there was some startup internet company guy who was paying his, touting that he was paying all of his people some crazy salary. I think some people were getting like 75 grand off the bat for like entry level type position stuff. And like within 6 months, he had to give up. Like, I don't know how many times people have to, I guess, but again, how many times does socialism or communism keep getting tried and fail miserably?
I don't know. They don't say in the article, maybe Dudley Doe doesn't know either, that it was actually their pay that put them out of business. I mean, they had $100,000 up front. That covered quite a few hours and, a few bucks an extra an hour. I don't know. I mean, is it possible, you can have pepperoni going out the back door or something? Were the managers of the store experienced pizza restaurant people? Did they know what they were doing, or was it just some people that wanted to do a good deed and said, hey, let's open a restaurant?
I don't know.
Not the sort of thing that you can always just learn on the fly.
Having worked in a couple, only in my younger years working in a couple of restaurants, just working inside of them, I don't think that's not even something I would walk into, even with the experience that I had being inside of it and like temporarily running one of them for a little while. Even then, I wouldn't think I would know how to run an entire restaurant. So yeah, you definitely have to have some know-how, but I would have to investigate this particular company further because it doesn't mention any of that. So who knows?
So perhaps paying above market wages, wasn't their downfall. I don't know. But I guess that's a real good first suspect in the demise of the
Well, yeah. if you're going to take them at their word that they were popular, you know, which you would assume would translate to bringing in some type of profit, you know, that if you take them at their word for that, then, you know, yeah, exactly. What else would the most, you know, what's the most likely culprit? Well, you're paying people an exorbitant amount of money for jobs that are not actually worth that much. And there's a reason the other restaurants in the area were all paying, you know, closer to the market wage versus what you decided to pay. And that's why they are all still in business and still surviving. And I assume thriving if they're staying in business where you are not.
You know, another article talking about the minimum wage, not minimum wage, but just the wages that are not high wages, like the wages that you'd be paid if you were at Walmart or probably any restaurant as an hourly employee, or in lots of places, I supposed. It's the every once in a while you see an article or a TV report or something about the high public cost of low wages. And to me, I can never wrap my mind around the logic of this. I guess it's an accusation or indictment against companies that pay people to do jobs that don't pay enough for the people to live on. And so what ends up happening is that you have people that don't make enough at their job at Walmart or whatever. I'm not picking on Walmart, but McDonald's or whoever. They don't make enough to live on, and maybe they've got kids at home or something, and they qualify for public benefits of some kind. And so now the government, state, federal, whatever, the government is giving them money. And now this blows up into a news story that says Walmart, McDonald's, all these businesses that are paying these wages that are low enough that the employees qualify for some public benefit are actually on welfare themselves, because the welfare is there to support, to keep Walmart or the other places in business. It's like it's their fault that they hired somebody, gave somebody a job.
How dare you, Walton family? Dare you?
That's, I mean, here they had a job that, yeah, that's who started Walmart.
I thought so, yeah.
Here in the Midwest, down in Arkansas, down south of where I am. And they blame them. And it was who would you blame if Walmart hadn't hired them, and instead the guy who paid even less than Walmart hired them? I guess they would be the villain instead of Walmart. But how you end up giving a guy a job and then, you know, then getting slapped around, you know, on TV or whatever, because you're actually now just, you're on welfare. The only reason that you can hire this person is because half of their income is being paid by the state government. And, yeah. I would almost turn that on its head and say, well, let's see, this person is willing to work for $8 an hour. And the reason that they're willing to work for that, in other words, that, you know, the market, is because the reason they're willing to work for that is because they have all this government subsidy coming in. And if the government subsidy wasn't there, then the wage picture would change, right? I mean, the supply and demand of wages and that, people, maybe they wouldn't work unless they got paid more money or something. So I don't know how you can push the blame in one direction or the other, and I'm no economist, but it just seems wrong that you blame the taxpayers should be blaming these businesses that give people that don't have jobs, but don't give them enough pay that they can avoid being eligible for public benefits.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, and I think before the show even started, and I said that I always find it interesting that when any of those conversations come up, and like Walmart in particular is brought into that conversation, because as far as I know, in pretty much every place that Walmart exists, they already pay higher than minimum wage to begin with. So for like people,
so
to
who's
be,
the villain here?
Yeah, exactly. Like there's
must
like,
be the federal government. They're setting the minimum wage up.
You know, but as far as like, you know, people being able to collect these, you know, the different types of welfare and stuff. I mean, because that's also increased. You know, I think it's now like anybody who makes like any household that's under 50. I think it's as high as like under 50,000 is eligible. Like under $50,000 a year is eligible for most of the benefits that they offer. Because I know that when my company was still in full swing. And I was filing basically for the whole family because my kid's mom wasn't working anymore because she was home with them, but we still qualified for like everything. We didn't take them. The only program that we ever made use of, well, she did. It was against my wishes, but I didn't have any say in the matter, unfortunately, was the Medicaid or the Medicare. I always forget which one it is, for the girls, because especially with my one daughter with all of her issues. But again, that was a choice that was taken out of my hands. But other than that, like obviously now that I'm out of work, we definitely qualify for like every single possible service. We just opt not to take it. You know, but that's just a personal decision, for the two of us. But yeah, it's the way the system's set up. And I think you're right. When you started to say before that, you know, maybe if these subsidies weren't there, maybe people, you know, either people might hold out for higher paying jobs, or they would recognize that all they can get because of their productivity level or their skill level or a combination of both, money is the only, you know, that's the highest they can get, so they'll end up having
might
to get
be
a second one of those
to
jobs.
Increase their skills.
Well, yeah, at least in the meantime, they'll have to pick up a second, you know, maybe pick up a second job that pays a similar salary and at least nets them a few more hours. But again, if they're in this structure where if they take a second job and they work too many hours and then they're no longer able to have access to certain welfare programs, then of course they're going to be disincentivized to work more. You know, just about anybody would be in that situation, because if usually that's what ends up happening. These people like that, you know, I know how it is. I was like this back in the day when you're like struggling and, you know, considering taking all these programs, because you look at it, it's like, well, you know, if I'm working like 20 something or whatever, 30 hours at this one job, and it's still allowing me to collect these benefits, but I have to get a second job. You know, I'd rather have a second job to take the benefits. Well, if I get this other job, if I work 30 hours there, then I don't get any of the benefits, and then I'm actually making either less money than I would have made with the one job and the benefit, and the, well, not the benefits, the welfare rather, or I'll make just a little bit more and have to be working so much, you know, so much more to get there. Why bother?
Right.
You know, it's a vicious cycle, but I've seen it happen, and I understand why it happens, and it's, you know, again, what's at the root? Government. But we're heading off to the market. Yeah, of course. Thanks, government.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
How about a warning? You're about to share with my friend Michael W. Dean, a survivor, thinks about humanity and his methods for dealing with it. Brace yourself for some bare naked honesty. If you're willing to hear what Michael is saying, there are times when you'll laugh and times when you want to cry. In the retelling of his truths, he has defined it so you can feel it. Take his example and live. I warned you earlier because this book is written in the same way Michael speaks. He's a straight shooter, a no pretense, a no excuses kind of guy that I love like a brother. Understanding how we are to deal with negative people, Michael has answers for you. The human race has its aberrations and monsters, and unfortunately, sometimes they are close to you. Michael gives you his take on them and how he handles the noise. I can guarantee you will pick up a tool to use from a user's manual for the human experience. As Michael says, his life is a teaching hospital.
A user's manual for the human experience. Kindle, paperback, and audiobook. Get it now on Amazon.
Yeah.
That was just meow.
Jeremy, I stepped on you again. I feel so.
It's fine. You think it. You know, just like we were talking earlier about, you know, things I should be used to already because I've dealt with it enough. Just like this, every time I've been on with you, I usually make the same comment too. You think I'd learn? I don't. But anyway, so we spent the first, well, actually pretty much the entire show so far talking about stuff like the minimum wage and the negative effects that government policies such as that have on people. And I actually had a story that I wanted to talk about, and we'll try to fit this in the short segment we have now. But right along the lines of, you know, the thanks government that we left off with the last segment, the government, the federal government this time, is back at it again, trying to ban kratom. You know, this, we talked about this, I guess it was last year when this happened, and we talked about this a lot because Michael, or rather his cousin Cash Newman, who's a big fan of kratom, and spoke about it extensively on the show for weeks on end, and there was this big push to try to ban it last year. But last year it was the DEA who was trying to find a way to ban this or put it on the you know, make it a Scheduled One drug and stuff like that, you know, up there with cocaine and heroin, just like they keep having marijuana for no apparent reason. But this time it's now the FDA that's trying to ban kratom, and they're doing it, of course, specifically to try to protect the pharmaceutical industry, because the pharmaceutical industry already seeing negative effects from any of the places that have either medical and or medical and recreational legalized cannabis now within the United States, like, you know, in Washington and Colorado and wherever else they've finally got it done now. They finally have medical here in New York, but you know, the pharmaceutical companies are already seeing a hit in those areas as far as people not needing their pain relief medications anymore. You know, like all the opioid stuff. All that stuff's down, all the oxys and stuff like that. The prescriptions are way down in those areas because people have turned to things like medical marijuana and kratom.
The crackdown on kratom is seen as an effort by the government to appease pharmaceutical companies who may be concerned about profit.
Well, exactly, because it's definitely what it is. They're, you know, like I said, they're already reeling a little bit in certain areas from this. And with kratom, it was legal everywhere for a while. Unfortunately, now some people, based on these BS studies that get put out by the government claiming all these negative effects of kratom and stuff like that, which is just not true. Very much like cannabis, there is no documented deaths that are actually directly tied to kratom. Any of the ones that they have tried to, that the different agencies or lobbyists on behalf of these agencies have tried to drag out there. There was actually so many other variables at play, like other drugs and stuff that were being mixed together too, that there's no way, like every time they bring one out, there's always other circumstances that they fail to mention. But if you actually look deeper at the story, it's like, no, this guy had a cocktail of things in his system. So, you know, to say it was kratom that killed him is just insanity.
Maybe it's a gateway drug.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it seems to actually have an effect of helping people get off heroin and other opioids, not lead them to them.
So you're saying opioids could be considered a gateway to kratom then?
Maybe. That is possible.
But that would be good.
Yeah, because I've personally, we've talked about it before on the show. I've taken it a bunch of times. I could see the benefits in using it long term. My kid's mom I've given it to her, the red strain, which is supposed to be for pain relief. And as I've discussed before, she has rheumatoid arthritis that hits her pretty bad, because as long as I've known her, she's been on a cocktail of, you know, Percocets, oxys, morphine and fentanyl patches. that she's had to wear to, you know, to get to relieve the pain, because when she, you know, goes through these flare-ups, it's like, you know, it's pretty much unbearable, you know, in her hands and back and stuff like that. But between a combination of CBD oil and the red kratom, she's actually done much, much better in the past year than she's done as long as I've known her. And
is kratom sold in stores?
It can be, yeah. There's depending, you know, as long as it's legal, that, you know, the, all the all like the head shops sell it now, and or you can buy it online. Yeah. So, but for now at least, because again, the FDA is trying to ban it. But last time it was actually stopped by We the People, so maybe they'll actually make some phone calls.
Well, it won't be banned this hour because it's over.
Yeah. Maybe in the next hour.
We'll be back. Yes, perhaps.
Are you tired of stinky socialists trying to take over America?
And are you also tired of theorists talking about the free market as a cure-all for every problem with no firsthand experience of how the market actually works?
Well, the Truth Justice American Way app gives you wall-to-wall shows by hosts who not only understand the market, but tell you how they make money in a variety of patriotic endeavors.
The Truth Justice American Way app for Android is 24/7 streaming audio content on the topics of finance, liberty, self-defense, and technology.
All the hosts are all American Americans from all over America.
And the app is made in Wyoming, the cowboy state.
Because you should buy American, even with free Android apps.
Truth Justice American Way. Useful information, compelling personalities, and superior American audio quality.
Go on the Google Play Store or the Amazon App Store and search Truth Justice American Way.
God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
This is the Freedom Fiend, broadcasting to the Libertarian Re-Education Center's low orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Peace Plaza, on the artificial satellite Live Pair 2017, in the Alpha Centauri region. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So we are back for the second hour. I am Jeremy, joined tonight by Randy. What's going on, Randy? Hello. How are you?
Hey, I'm here, still awake. It's
well, that's a good start.
It's about 1 o'clock in the morning here in mid Missouri, and it's quiet and cold.
But
not here in my front room where I've got the Freedom Fiends up and going. So. Doing all right.
That's good.
And I think we probably finished the Kratom discussion.
Yeah.
We ended talked. The last hour with. And I ran across an article. It's probably, it's a week old. Entitled, Why the Worst Humans Are Able to Rise to Power. And
Trump.
Well, the writer, who is a Brittany Hunter, is really doing sort of a summation in her comment on a chapter from The Road to Serfdom by Hayek.
Great book, so I hear.
Yeah. That's right. No, Jeremy. We know that you've read all of these books, so just...
Oh, of course. I kid, yes.
Yeah.
My library is filled with books I have read. They're all of them, every single one of them.
Yes. Well, anyway, I was about to say that Hayek, he makes 3 points in this book that he wrote, I think, after World War II. And as you read it, it's pretty clear that he has in mind people like Hitler and, you know, Mussolini. People that came to power, not in a total dictatorship. I don't know.
Democratically.
Only people that came into power democratically rather than, say, a Stalin or something.
Or a military coup or something like that. Yeah,
that sort of thing. And she sets out, it's very interesting, Hayek's three reasons that he has why it seems like the nastiest, worst people end up in positions of power and end up running countries and that sort of thing. And some of them, I'm not sure what I think about them or not, but we could kind of go through them. And you know, I wonder what you would think of these too. And his first point that Hayek makes is one that's kind of along the lines of saying, well, good people that would be very qualified to run something very complicated and hard to do, like running a country, smart people, educated people, whatever, have very, very little in common with not his word, but mine, the rabble, the common man or something. And Hayek said, and this is a quote, "If we wish to find a high degree of uniformity and similarity of outlook, we have to descend to the regions of lower moral and intellectual standards, where the more primitive and common," in quotes, "common instincts and tastes prevail." So it sounds like he's saying that the leader has to play toward these base morals, base instincts, and a least common denominator of humanity, and who is better able to pander to those sensibilities than somebody that's as low as the common man. And that's his first point. And it's kind of, you know, condescending, would you say that?
Maybe just a little.
You know, and you know, it's half condescending, half true, perhaps. You know, you mentioned earlier, you know, Donald Trump, you said. Did you say that on the air? Just
I was coughing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, well, anyway, but that's not saying I'm not calling him Hitler or Mussolini or anything like that. But on the other hand, he kind of fits the picture of this and the tastes of what they're talking about in this point one, where Hayek he appeals to this I hate to say it because it just sounds so condescending and unkind, but it seemed like he does pander to this low view, you know, what, least common denominator, is that a nicer way to put it? And keep him in the back of my mind as I'm going through each one of these points of Hayek's, because the comparison only gets better between Hayek's points and Donald Trump, and that may be just in my mind. But let me go on. I'll go to the second one.
Okay.
The second point is that the leader will be the sort who is, quote, "able to obtain the support of all the docile and gullible who have no strong convictions of their own, but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values, if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently." Hayek didn't have a real high view of the common man, did he?
Well, I mean, again, isn't it? I mean, is he wrong?
I'm not saying that he's wrong. I'm just saying that he doesn't. It to my modern ears, this grinds. I can see where anyone reading this might say that's kind of offensive.
Well, you know, I guess that's, you know, maybe that's, it's probably my Aspergerianism coming out, that I read that without any emotion attached to it. So I'm just like, oh, it's true. All right, moving on.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad there's somebody here that can just speak truth to morons.
Yeah,
okay?
Speaking truth to, all right, there's our show title.
No offense, anybody. Absolutely. All right.
Oh, that's great.
It's late. All right. So that's the second point that he makes. And that kind of, I'm not sure how that one fits in real well with Donald Trump, that if he had a kind of a ready-made program that if he just beat on it hard enough, it would, you know, people would would buy into it. I'll leave that.
Maybe to an extent. I mean, although he doesn't necessarily have a program, but they've like designed one for him, and it was kind of like the alt-right program vehicle, whatever system, that system of values that kind of carried him through everything, at least got him to the presidency. So,
well, it got him a long way. Although, you know, one thing that I always thought was a bad rap on Trump was, you know, the alt-right. I don't know. To generalize, I don't know if it's fair. Certainly the Charlottesville thing and all that is getting to be very much about race. And Donald Trump, they always accused Donald Trump, you know, the Democrats would accuse him of being a racist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't ever recall him ever saying anything, and this is just maybe my sensibilities are just not developed well, but I never saw him in anything he did or said that set off any alarm bells that he was, had any axe to grind against any particular racial group, except of course
the Mexicans
south of the border. Yeah, that one right there. But they were always trying to whip up, black Americans and whatever other hyphenated Americans there were out there to say, well, he's just a racist. And I'm thinking, I don't know if any of these people have any bone to pick with him, except that the fact that he is a rich white guy. But that alone, maybe enough to be a racist. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it is either. But
views.
Oh yeah, but I agree with you. I never saw anything from him either that made me actually think that any of that was true. And it was when I mentioned like the alt-right helping carry him there. It was definitely them clinging to him, not the other way around. It wasn't like he sought them out. They flocked to him. I don't think it was that's why I said I didn't think it was his set of values, but it was a set of values that was kind of foisted on him. Like one of the best explanations I heard about Trump from like early on was Jim Jesus. He was just like he's a human Rorschach. You know, he's just like he's whatever people want him to be, because that's how he's going to work. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, he was what people needed him to be to get elected. And now he's whatever the power, whatever the powers that be need him to be to get things done that they want to get done.
I think that's really good, because I have so many friends that were, huge supporters of Donald Trump. And, not that I gave a whit for Hillary Clinton, but, you talk to the people you're talking to, and I'd say, but don't you, just absolutely hate X, Y, and Z? Oh, yeah, yeah. I said, well, then you wouldn't like him. And it's like, I don't care. I like this, Okay. Yeah. So anyway, that's the second point. First of all, you need to have a guy who has lots in common with your average Joe. And how I see that it does fit with Donald Trump. He's not Joe Sixpack, because he's a billionaire and lives with the beautiful people in New York City and wherever and all that sort of thing. He's nothing like them. But when he gets on the stage and up to a microphone,
he talks like them.
He talks like them. He blows hard like some bully in a bar. And so he actually is like the people that my Hayek's point number one is talking about. And then, like I said, the point number two is that he has the gullible and docile they're willing to have this plan of his drummed into them. And I'm not sure how that fits. But we're about to go out to the market, and we'll come back after that for point number three from Hayek.
Worms.
That sound good?
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Hi, this is Mark Edge of Free Talk Live. Michael W. Dean's book, User's Manual for the Human Experience, changed my life. In a culture that attempts to turn you into a compliant victim, this book gives you implementable steps on everything from how to be aware of your environment walking down the street to business, to how to handle a toxic person in your life. If you're a human, you need to read this book at least once. Go to Amazon and get the Kindle version. or paperback, or an audiobook of A User's Manual for the Human Experience.
Freedom Fiends. We're back from the market, and we were talking about Friedrich Hayek's 3 points, or ways, or reasons that the worst people get on top in terms of becoming leaders. And I think we were just finishing up his second point. And
yeah,
I don't know if we have anything more for that before we go to point three.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one thing, because you had said mentioned it twice that you weren't sure how you could really necessarily jive that the second point with Trump. But yeah. I think what's actually written what Brittany Hunter wrote after the quote from Hayek here, I think you can actually make a case for it to a certain extent, because it's like talking about how what was actually going on with the German people at the time, you know, because again that, you know, this was all kind of aimed at people like Hitler and Mussolini and stuff like that, you know, the economy's in bad shape. You know, because of the long-term war, which one of the huge reasons the American economy is in horrible shape is because of the long-term war, 16 years and running now in Afghanistan. you know, and then also that. I mean, well, the war is not necessarily done, but you know, women were widowed. Yep, this happens here. Limbs are lost. Yeah, a lot of people end up getting blown up with IEDs and stuff like that, and end up losing limbs. And there's plenty of people that I've seen double and triple amputees coming back from this stuff. Morale was at an all time low. Morale's pretty low for most people. I mean, you know, overall. Like the happiness index, pretty low for America. Trust in or favorability of everybody, pretty low. Even Trump himself right now, pretty low. But you know, all those type of things are kind of going on to a lesser extent, obviously, with the war, because at least we're not getting bombed on like the people of Germany were throughout all that. But everything else kind of fits too, you know. So I don't know. Like I said, maybe I'm stretching it a little bit, but I thought you could make a case that you could see a little Trump in that, in what he was trying to say.
And let me go on to the third one here, and then we can circle back to if anything else occurs. The third one I think is probably the most intuitive and obviously true. And Hayek pointed out that as far as the leader's program, their chief program is going to be to go after some enemy. Hayek said it's easier for people to agree on a negative program, on the hatred of an enemy, on the envy of those who are better off, than on any positive tasks. And of course, you know, for Hitler it was for the Jews and whoever else. You know,
the gypsies, the gays.
Yeah, he had a list.
Ironically, despite the name of the Nazi Party, the socialists. They were some of the first people they went after. They just called themselves socialists to be able to be looked upon better by the worldwide community. But they actually went after the actual socialists first.
Yeah, the communists that came. You know, they had made inroads right after World War One, it wasn't certain that the communists would not get a hold of Germany.
Yes.
But then, you know, they in the end, they only got a hold of half of it because of Hitler. But going back to Trump, you know, seeing how that one fits, that he definitely had that. Oddly enough, in the campaign, he had that. The thing with the immigrants, you know, build the wall. In the campaign, I think he was pretty nasty on
ISIS too.
ISIS and Iran, North Korea.
Yes, he is Iran. Well, no, North, North Korea, I think actually was after he got elected, but Iran, he was definitely
it's the
on
one that's
before.
Been in the news. Iran was big in the campaign. The immigrants were big in the campaign. Not as big after. They keep talking about. I don't think he wants to talk about it now because the wall isn't there yet, and it's kind of embarrassing. You know, it's kind of like he didn't want to talk about.
You just wait.
Harassing.
My first 100 days are going to be great. It's going to be huge. Huge 100 days.
Huge. They're definitely going to be.
We're already at 6 months now, counting. Nine months at this point.
Oh, yeah. Ten months. Almost 11 months. Keep counting. Tomorrow is the 23rd. Is that the day the president is sworn in?
I think it's the 20th. I think January 20th, maybe.
We're past that. So, yeah.
10 months, yeah.
10 months, right now.
Good job, Donnie.
We'll be back.
Yes.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
And we're back.
I'm hey, Jeremy.
That's Randy. We're still here. And we've been talking about this article written by Brittany Hunter about why the worst humans are able to rise to power. And, you know, basically it's going through, as Randy started off saying, you know, going through one of the chapters in Hayek's Road to Serfdom. And basically outlining his three reasons why he believed this was the case. And I think we had gotten through all three of them. But you said, Randy, that you actually had, after reading this a couple of times, you kind of formulated what you believed was a fourth one that you would, if you were writing this type of thing, you might have added to the list or something like that, right?
Well, I can't take credit, but was Hayek Jewish? You know if he was Jewish?
I can't remember. I think so, but I want to say yes, but I don't really remember. I should probably look that up.
The fourth point I want to add to his list of why the worst end up in these top jobs and being the rulers, and is taken out of the Jewish scriptures, which I ran into at one point and made a note of it. And in the Old Testament, and I don't know if you remember back when the Israelites came into the land of Israel after they got out of Egypt from being slaves and all that stuff, and they had their leader was a guy named Gideon. He was what they call a judge, and they after he got them settled in the land and they killed all the people in Palestine that were in there ahead of them or whatever. Won't get into that. That's another story. They came to Gideon and they wanted to make him their king. They really wanted a king. And he said he refused. He wasn't going to be their king. He says, I'm not going to rule over you. And my son's not going to rule over you. That's not the way we do it. You know, you got the law for Moses. You just follow it. And if there's a dispute or something, you know, the judges, that's what the judges do. They judge. If there's some kind of dispute or about the rules, you know, we'll say what they are, but otherwise we're not going to rule you. Go rule your own lives. And when Gideon died, he was a judge for like 40 years, and then he died, and the guy had 70 sons. But as it turns out, the biggest villain of all his 70 sons, one of them was the worst, a guy named Abimelech. And the first thing, as soon as Gideon dies, Abimelech seizes power like over in one little place. And proceeds to murder every single one of his 70 brothers, or should I say 69 brothers, except for one, this guy named Jotham, I think was his name. And at some point, Jotham came out from his hiding And he came to call out this Abimelech because he was such bad. He was obviously he was a murderer, and he was trying to consolidate his power, and came to the town where Abimelech, you know, lived, and started telling a parable. And it was, they call it the parable of the trees. And it went like this. The trees once went out to anoint a king over themselves. So they said to the olive tree, "Reign over us." The olive tree answered them, "Shall I stop producing my rich oil by which gods and mortals are honored to go and rule over the trees?" So the olive tree won't do it. Then the trees go to the fig tree and say, "You come and you rule over us." And the fig tree says, "Shall I stop producing my sweetness and my delicious fruit to go and rule over the trees?" And he won't do it. And then the trees went to the vine and said, "You reign over us." And the vine says, "No, my wine cheers gods and mortals. I'm not going to come and rule over you trees." And of course, what happens then is that since they're unable to recruit any other decent, productive, reputable plant to rule over them, the trees asked Thornbush to rule over them, and the Thornbush took the job. And this is my fourth point that I would add to Hayek. And one of the reasons that the worst will always get to the top is because most of the good, productive people that actually have lives to live and, you know, are going to help rather than, you know, rule over other people or trees, they refuse. They just won't do it. And I read that. It reminded me of J.R.R. Tolkien, who once wrote a letter to his son, and I think his most famous quote among libertarians is the one about how he was an anarchist or something. But
I'm coming part of that closer, same, closer to anarchism or something like that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But he also said in that same letter that the most improper job of any man is bossing other men. Not one in a million is fit for it. Least of all those who seek the opportunity. So, you know, I don't know if you ran the numbers on that, but no, basically no one is fit to, you know, to rule over other people. That's not why we were here. And the first qualifier, I mean, immediately is seeking out the job is like, it's a disqualifier all by itself. And so, I remember a while back, where was it? I listened to Tom Woods. Didn't he just have his 1,000th podcast or something?
And
he
had
it did the whole thing in front of an audience. I don't know if he was in a theater or something. I'm not sure what it was, but it seemed to me at the time.
Issue
came up, and someone somewhere, I don't know if they had a question. I think I could be wrong, but I think it was then. Someone was suggesting that Tom Woods should run for the Libertarian Party for president in 2020. And, you know, when you hear that Tom Woods, you know, you're thinking, well, he might be good. But Tom Woods immediately says, no way. There's no way that's going to happen. Just forget that. Just shut up.
Yeah.
It will not happen. It'll never happen. And, and then, you know, when that happened, it kind of called this thing to mind to me. I'm going, yeah, well, of course he'd say that. And if he was going for it, you know, I understand how somebody get drafted. And I'm not, you have the example of Ron Paul. He ran for president. I don't even know if Ron Paul is a good example in the sense that, boy, he's kind of a one of a kind. I mean, anybody who was in Washington, D.C. for as many years as he was, and you know, still, you know, basically held to his principles. They're not going to come along very often.
No.
But instead, the Libertarian Party, you know, so William Weld is still looking at maybe being the nominee in 2020. And I just want to beat my head on the wall, and then I'm thinking, no, it just proves the rule that the worst candidate is the one that's going to go up there and get it, which is why I don't put much stock in the Libertarian Party.
If I did, that's usually a pretty good rule.
Yeah, no kidding. So yeah. I don't know. That's kind of a, maybe a rule that I would add that you know, one of the reasons the worst get to the top is because anybody, you know, anybody that's decent would refuse.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think we were talking earlier in the break at the top of the hour, and I said that, you know, either they flat out refuse, or, you know, you see this happen with in the political game. You know, you see it happen other places too, like on, you know, with the cops and stuff like that. You know, good people go in there and they try, and they either quit, they either give up because they realize how screwed up things really are and that there's nothing, no power that they actually have, or they hang around, but are made ineffective, you know, especially in the game of politics, they're made ineffective by, you know, not getting any of the good committee positions or anything like that. So they effectively have no real power, you know, and, you know, if they don't want to play ball with anybody with the establishment, then they can't get anything done at all. And most of the time, the ones that stick around long enough that end up playing ball just to try to get some of their stuff done, just so they can say they actually did something good, end up getting corrupted. Because, you know, it goes back to what this article starts off with, mentioning the you know, the Lord Acton quote about absolute power and it corrupting absolutely. Because it does, you know, you stay in there, you know, I've seen it happen just on, you know, the however long I've been here on Long Island paying attention to the political scene, where you see people who are actually, like, you know them to be decent people in their personal lives before that, and they get in, they just kind of get, they end up getting twisted because they just get sucked into the system, and they,
well, sure,
you may be honest
and decent on election day, but by the time the polls come in midnight that night, you got one thing left on your mind, and that's re-election, and that just colors everything. I ran for office once. I ran for prosecutor and attorney, and you know, and at the time I hated, I just despised the whole idea. I hated it because I just wanted to do my job, and my boss was going to leave, and I had to either run or go somewhere else, and so I did. And I can't imagine, it's like the corruption would be automatic. I just think of myself and I'm going, well, yeah, if I'd have won, I'd have immediately started thinking about, you know, protecting my position 4 years from now. And that's horrible. To put a human being into that situation is really impossible. You know, I mentioned Ron Paul earlier. Now, I'm not saying that if he would have been elected president, that he would have been corrupted. The problem is that if a libertarian was elected president, they would either be corrupted or they would be impeached and nothing flat. Because you think of the things that a real libertarian would have to do, like a Ron Paul would have to do. I mean, wouldn't he immediately have to bring home all the troops?
Well, yeah.
Or at least make an
effort too. But then that's where they would just, you know, well, it could happen through impeachment. But I was going to say, in general, he would just, you know, that if that type of president, if he ever actually did get in, would just be made ineffective, you know, virtually, because there's you know, even if they veto stuff, their vetoes can be overridden by, like, what is it, the 2/3 vote of Congress, I think, can override.
Well, the president the president has the power to put any soldier anywhere he wants, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying
commander, he can call up and say, you guys, and you guys, in fact, all you guys, come home. I don't think they could get home before he was impeached.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree on that.
Yeah.
That's probably the case.
Sounds kind of hopeless, yeah.
Land of the not so free. Yeehaw.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
Agreed.
groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon. Your house is your property.
So we're back for the last segment, Redemption of the Third Act, and we have some hopeful redemption, I guess, coming up, because this isn't official yet, but it's something hopefully going that direction. It's been announced that the chief of the FCC has actually made a move to try to eliminate the net neutrality regulations that were put in place toward the end of good old Obama's last term as president, and I think they have to vote on it now. I think the vote's coming up next month, and you know, we'll see. But he's trying to strike down most of it. Although, according to the article, he actually agrees with the principle of net neutrality, which I don't. But we should probably, before we probably lead any further, Randy, what actually is net neutrality, or what is actually they're trying to stop here, and why do we actually like this? They're stopping things.
Well, supposedly net neutrality means that all traffic on the internet has to be treated equally, so that everybody has exactly the same access, and Facebook can't get faster, you know, bandwidth or something than Netflix or Amazon or some little startup somewhere. And, you know, it sounds like one of those, you know, I mean, if you put it that way, that, you know, people can't take advantage of other people or something, I guess it sounds good, but it's not.
We're protecting the customers. No, you're price fixing, and price fixing is bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's not exactly price. Well, it could be price fixing.
To a certain extent, it is.
Well, it's not so much price fixing as it's product fixing.
Yeah. Okay.
Like you have to deliver this exact same product. So if you had somebody who said, "Well, you know, I don't really want to buy a Cadillac. I just need a little moped to ride around on. So could I get this lesser bandwidth or speed or capacity and pay less money?" And the government says, "No, you can't do that. You're going to have a Cadillac just like people that could afford Cadillac." And, you know, that's the way, you know, I saw it, because it seems to me that when everybody has to take exactly the same product, half the people are going to be forced to buy more than what they really need or want.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, having an insurance program forced upon you, whether you want it or not, with all these things that you don't necessarily or will ever actually need, you know, like pregnancy services for men or whatever that was that ended up on Obamacare.
Well, everybody knows that without the individual mandate, Obamacare can't be the raving success that it is. Which is, you know, so ironic. Of course, it's exactly the same subject, but it's off the subject. But you just want to find somebody to dump on, and you want to find some crony or some over here that you can help. And so you want to help people with pre-existing illnesses and that. So you find a bunch of 20 and 30 somethings that don't need the insurance or don't need much, and you put a gun to their head and say, "You're going to have to buy it, because you're the ones that have to pay for these poor people, you know, with pre-existing illnesses, and we got nowhere else to go, and we can't put it on to the 50-year-olds because, well, they've got health problems of their own,
and they're
just, all they can do is they're carrying their own weight. But say, you're not carrying anything, so step up here, and you know, young people really get the shaft of this country, 20-year-olds, you know, and even 30 may be worse, because by then a lot of people have families and multiple kids and, you know, lots of responsibilities, and yet you have to buy this, you have to buy that.
Well, yeah, that goes back to the conversation we had earlier about the people that have jobs and are still on welfare. It was working families was the classification of those people, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So. Of course, I'm retiring this year, and I need those 20 and 30 somethings to pay their Social Securities.
Yeah,
don't give up yet.
You're probably the last generation who's going to get it, so you know, as well make use of it.
I tell you what, if I had to give it up tomorrow, it'd be worth it.
Sure. Oh, I give up on my years ago. But anyway,
I give it up. I don't even get it yet.
But, yeah. No, story for another time. But
yes, it is.
It's a great show, Randy. Thanks for joining
us
tonight.
Yes, yes. Well, I appreciate you once again being willing to be on the show with me.
Arms.